This podcast is for entertainment purposes only and does not replace your own financial, tax, legal, or financial product advice.
Well, hello, hello, Australia. Welcome to My Millennial Money. I'm Glenn James. Today on the podcast, it's another episode where I'm out of my depth, where I'm talking to these hugely famous and popular people and intelligent people from all around the world, and I've got no bloody idea. We are joined by Peter Singer today. I reached out to Peter to come on the podcast again. He was on the podcast last year, and the reason why was to talk a little bit about ethics, because there was a bit of chatter in the Facebook group some time ago, and it got into this debate, which kind of boiled down to, is owning an investment property ethical? So I thought, let's get Peter Singer back on and have a chat. So we talked to Peter about his new book. We talk about his tour, and we answer your listener questions. And then I ask what he does with his own investing. So that will be a good one. You're in for a treat. And again, apologies, give me grace. I'm so out of my depth. I'm just a bogan from the Central Coast who's got no bloody idea. And if you are new to the podcast world and this is your first episode, thanks for listening. I know you've got a choice and I really appreciate you choosing us to have a listen to. And if you've been a listener for some time, also thanks for sticking around. We've got other podcasts. We've got My Millennial Health, Chloe and Jess. They just talk all about health and wellness, all the good stuff, sleep, gut health, nutrition, work-life balance, all the stuff you need to be the best version of you. Shell and Em do My Millennial Career. So if you want to excel in your career, if you want to take your career to the next level and be encouraged, you can check that out. Another podcast that's not part of the My Millennial family, but we do it, it's called Gen Z Money. So if you're under kind of 24 years old and you want some further encouragement around your money, Azaria Bell is the host of Gen Z Money. So you can check that out wherever you're listening to this podcast. All right, let's have a listen to me make a fool of myself. Thanks, guys. I'll talk to you soon. Bye. G'day, Peter. How are you?
G'day, Glenn. I'm doing well.
You're back on Aussie turf.
I certainly am.
What's it been like in the States at the moment?
I haven't been there for a while now, but you know, from what my friends are saying, things are a little better than they used to be, but they're certainly still quite far from normal, and they're all worried with the new contagious viruses around, and now this problem with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, similar problem to what we have with AstraZeneca, so that's putting some people off getting vaccinated, so we're not out of the woods yet over there.
No, not at all. Now, if you are new to the podcast, after this episode, you might want to go back and have a listen to episode 305, where I interviewed Peter about the life you can save and effective altruism. But today, I want to have a chat with Peter about ethics in general, investing, and we'll see where it takes us. We've got a heap of listener questions. Peter, I want to talk to you about your new book, but before we do that, you did plan to have a speaking tour last year, but COVID got in the way of that. You are touring in August, Australia and New Zealand. Can you tell us a little bit about the tour?
Yes. It's a tour being organized by a company called Think Inc. I'm going to Auckland, Brisbane, Sydney and Melbourne. I'll be speaking in each of those cities. And the purpose of the tour, it's called An Evening with Peter Singer. I'll be talking about a variety of issues, but the overriding purpose is to get people to think about global poverty, what we can do about it as citizens of a reasonably affluent country, and to actually raise money for the Life You Can Save Australia, which is an organization that I founded. It's actually a US-based organization, but it has an Australian branch or chapter, to promote the most effective charities helping people in extreme poverty. So people want to find out more about the speaking tour, they can go to Think Inc's website, or you can have a look at thelifeyoucansave.org.au and find out more about the tour and about the organization that is it's in aid of.
Yeah, wonderful. And if you are going to join us in Sydney, look out for me, because I've certainly got my tickets ready for last year, but they carry over if you've already got your tickets from last year. Now, your new book, The Golden Ass, I've got a couple of questions for you, because I think it sounds pretty wild. And correct me if I'm wrong, but it's one of the oldest novels that you've re-edited.
That's correct. It may well be the oldest surviving novel we have, which surprised me when I first heard about it, because when I was in school, I was told that maybe Gulliver's Travels was the oldest novel. And then I realized that was a bit of a kind of Anglo perspective, and Don Quixote was at least 100 years earlier than that, and that's certainly a novel. And then other people say, well, that's still a Eurocentric perspective, because what about The Tale of Genji, which is a story about a court in Japan, written, I think, in the 11th century, so that's a lot older still. But this is written in the Roman period, in fact, at the heyday of the Roman Empire in the second century of the current era. So it's 1800 years old, and it depends a little what you count as a novel, of course. You could see the Iliad and the Odyssey as novels, but they were really more like sagas chronicling what was believed to be history. And this is really a novel in the sense of it's a fantastic tale about a man who dabbles in magic and gets turned into a donkey, and his adventures as a donkey, you know, how he eventually emerges from that to tell the story. And it's funny. It's pretty bawdy. There's some erotic passages in it, both before he's a donkey and after he's a donkey. You know, it's really good fun to read. But the problem with the original, and I think maybe this is a reason why people hadn't thought of it as a novel, I hadn't read it much, is there's a lot of stories embedded in it. So you know, donkeys have big ears, and they hear a lot of things, and this donkey hears people telling stories and retells some of these stories, which have nothing to do with the main story of the adventures of the man who gets turned into a donkey. So it kind of continually gets interrupted, and the thread of the narrative gets lost. And I thought, what about if you pruned away these digressions and just had the main narrative? And that makes it relatively short. It's about 35 and 40,000 words, makes it a really good read, I think. And the other thing that attracted it to me, of course, is that it's very empathetic about the sufferings of a donkey. So you learn a lot about what a donkey would go through in the second century, in the Roman period, which was not particularly kind to animals. We all know about the Roman games in the Colosseum, but it's told very well, and I think it gets us to think about animals, and presumably got people in those times to think about animals too. So it's pretty remarkably advanced, I would say, in its attitude to animals for the era in which it was written.
When you went back into the book, did you learn anything or take a new perspective from it that you might not have picked up, you know, years earlier?
Oh, certainly. I think there are many things that you can get from it. One is the picture that you get of Roman life, or life in the Roman Empire at that time. And to some extent, the similarities in the attitudes to animals that most people had. So, for example, this donkey gets sold in various places, and at one point is bought by somebody who's operating a mill, a mill for grinding corn into flour. And the donkey is simply like a machine. The donkey is harnessed to the millstone and has to walk around in circles with blinkers on all day long. And essentially the donkey is being worked to death, and the donkey reports on the other donkeys and horses that are there that are more or less worn out, and they're living in semi-darkness. They're just fed enough to keep them going. So it's an attitude of, you know, animals just as machines to work for us. And it's interesting that that was there then, and to some extent that's there now in modern factory farming, that, you know, in fact, I have a quote in my book, Animal Liberation, which says, you know, think of the hen as just a machine to produce eggs. And, you know, the profits that you make are what you get from the eggs, less the costs of the fuel, which is the food that you have to feed the hen, and the maintenance. So that's an attitude to animals that goes back at least 2,000 years, maybe more, that we can see, we recognize in the work animals of the Roman Empire, and we recognize in the factory farms we have today.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because I, like, with the book, there's themes of, and these are the things that I wrote down, sex, love, laughter, pranks, drunkenness, there's a heap of metaphors, there's death, there's witchcraft, you know, it covers everything. In reading the book and looking at humanity now, there hasn't been that much of a deviation, as in, like, we might not see public lynching of witches anymore, but all those other themes are quite central to humanity right now. Do you find, in reading this book and your reflections of the work that you do, that humanity has moved far for the better?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I think one of the things you do recognize, because the author, Apuleius, clearly had an eye for human nature and for human foibles. And so some of the stories, that some of the ones that are still in the book, are about human nature not really having changed. There's, you know, tales about adultery and cheating of various kinds, and people trying to advance their own interests unscrupulously. And of course, you know, the media are full of some similar stories today. So in some of those basics, I think human nature has not changed. And I do have an essay at the end of the book, after the novel, talking about that and asking the question specifically with regard to our treatment of animals. Are we better than the Romans were? And, you know, as you say, with witches not being lynched or burned, we could say, well, we don't have spectacles of animals being slaughtered and tortured, which is not quite right, because we do have, at least some countries have bullfights, for example, and other countries, even if it's illegal, may have dogfighting or cockfighting as a sport. But yes, we don't allow that. We don't do that openly in any way in many countries of the world. But really what we've done, I think, is we've hidden a lot of the animal suffering. We've put it into factory farms, we've put it into laboratories, and the public generally doesn't see it unless somebody goes in undercover and takes a video and shows the world what's going on. And when we think about that, we're not really all that better. You know, given the alternatives we have, given that we don't need to do this to animals to survive, you could even say that we're worse. You know, you could say, well, the Romans had to grind their corn into flour in order to live, and they didn't really have alternatives. They didn't have electricity to do that or other forms of power. So they had to do that. And yet, you know, we don't have to eat animals. We don't have to have the products of factory farmed animals. It doesn't help us feed the planet at all. If anything, the reverse, it wastes food. So, I think we're not really any better in respect of our treatment of animals. And, you know, you could go through other areas and there would be some things in which we're somewhat better and other things in which we're not.
I wonder if we are getting closer to a tipping point on this animal issue. And I like to think in parallels, just so it's easy for me to understand and an existing schema that I understand. I think it was a professor out of Cornell, Robert Frank. He was on the podcast recently. And I think in his book, he was talking about, you know, when they created the motor vehicle, it was solving a problem and it was revolutionary. And no one really cared about carbon emissions then, but now we've kind of forgot about the basic thing that it's doing for us and it's part of our everyday life. Now we're actually thinking of the byproduct of that. And I wonder if it is the same type of parallel with the factory farming. Like, no one cared, you know, 50 years ago that there was factory farms because it was giving us what we need. But now we've moved to this point where it's like, well, hang on, this isn't right. And there can be another way.
Well, I think that's, you know, I know Robert Frank's work, and I think he's certainly right about the automobile, that we have to find better ways, and we are starting to find better ways for doing that. And it's definitely true that I'm not sure that we ever needed factory farming really, but certainly people believe they did, and I would say it's something that developed because of the laws of the marketplace, and if people were going to look for the cheapest chicken or the cheapest pork in the supermarket, then the factory farmer was going to win because they can produce more cheaply than the others. But in terms of really needing these products or of, you know, producing food to feed the world, factory farming was never the answer to that.
And I think that's a good segue, because there is a few listener questions that touch on this within our modern economy. So are you right to get into some questions, Peter?
Absolutely. I'd be happy to take questions that your listeners have asked.
All right. Well, the first question, and before I ask it or get you to answer it, the reason I reached out to Peter was there was some chatter in the Facebook group about someone asking a question about they purchased an investment property and they were getting negative comments around this, and then it moved into this thing that a question is that is owning an investment property unethical? But I think what we probably need to understand first, Peter, is maybe a couple of thoughts about ethics 101. How do we establish our own ethics and, I guess, principles or, you know, guiding lights, whatever it is, in our own lives? Because what's ethical to me might not be ethical to my neighbor.
Yes, that's true. People do have different ethical standards, and they have them often from their childhood or their family background. Sometimes their religious beliefs. Sometimes people just think differently about these things. But I do think that there are, you know, if you go up in a way to the more basic level, you get a fair amount of agreement. I'm not saying you get total agreement, but I think we all agree that making people, and I would include animals too, so I would say sentient beings, making them suffer for no reason is a bad thing. And conversely, making them better off, improving their well-being, making them happier, is a good thing. And that's, I think, a kind of a common currency that any defensible moral view will have. It may put limits on that. It may say, well, you mustn't violate certain rights or you mustn't break certain moral rules to do that. But they will say, if you're not violating rights or breaking moral rules, then yes, you should relieve suffering where you can. It's better that fewer people suffer. It's better that the people be happier. So I think that this is a good starting point. And for me, in fact, I don't think that there are moral rules that are absolute. I think it's useful to have moral rules as a kind of general guide to what's the right thing to do. But I don't think any of them are absolute. Ultimately, I think they all depend on do they conduce to improving the well-being of all sentient beings or not. And so those are the rules that I would embrace and that I would look to as a guide when you come up against an ethical question that, you know, you haven't thought about much before. Then I would say, well, what will produce the best consequences for all of those affected by my action? And that's the way to go.
So to be blunt, is owning an investment property unethical?
Well, if you ask a question like that, I think there's a distinction that needs to be drawn as to how you're looking at this. And it's a question that's, you know, I often get asked about money. For example, I took part in a debate at the Oxford Union before the COVID thing about, can it be ethical to be a billionaire? So you know, if you say, would there be an ideal system in which people didn't own investment properties or didn't own investment properties while there are other people who are homeless, can't find somewhere to live, then the answer might be, you know, yes, we can imagine an ideal system. But the second question is, given the world we're living in now and giving my inability to change that system, at least in the foreseeable future, what is the right thing to do? So if the question about is it ethical to own an investment property is asked by somebody living in the world now, then you have to look at the consequences of not owning an investment property and the consequences of nobody owning an investment property, if that's really what you're thinking about. And the result of that would be, again, within the present system, that there was no rental properties available or for people to rent, you know, that very little anyway. Maybe sometimes people would go overseas for a while and rent their home. But basically, the large number of apartments we have that are still for rent, a lot of them, of course, are been strata titled and are owned by the apartment owners, residents. But it's clearly good to have some rental properties. There are a lot of people who can't afford to buy their home, and somewhere to rent, not too expensive, is important. So I wouldn't say to ethical people who are thinking about ethics, you can't own a rental property. I would say, think about the kind of rental property you're owning. Think about, are you providing a service for people who can't afford to buy a home to live in, or maybe they're saving up for a home to live in? Are you charging a reasonable rental that people can afford to buy? There are all those kinds of questions that that can be raised about it. You know, some people might say own a block of apartments, but make some of them available to asylum seekers or people who really couldn't get in, and then they're providing a service for them as well as providing housing for people who aren't quite that badly off, but still couldn't afford to buy their own home.
Do you think, because I'd thought of this question for some time, and I was wondering, when people get bogged down with this question that investment property, it's unethical, is it perhaps, you know, and absolutely, I'm saying this to everybody listening with all respect and saying it under the guise of this topic, this interview with Peter, like Glenn James is so out of his depth. I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm just trying to facilitate a conversation. Do you think there's a confusion and you've picked the wrong fight, because you're actually wanting to fight about, I disagree with capitalism and that system of money, where there needs to be some more balance? Because we know the extremes, Peter, either end of the spectrum, either issue, extremes are really bad. So extreme capitalism, like, you just have to look at the States. I believe it's a basket case, you know, the way that, you know, healthcare works and freedom and democracy and pew, pew, pew and all that stuff, where I think Australia's pretty well balanced. So I guess I'm saying, leading into a statement before I let you answer, is there a role for us citizens to lobby governments and say, well, hey, we think that it is reasonable that one investment property is cool, the second one, there might be some higher taxes or something like that? I don't know. I'm just throwing out words and thoughts.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think you're right that within the capitalist system that we live in, and which, as I say, I don't see us overthrowing in the foreseeable future, not in my lifetime anyway. There are a lot of listeners, but most listeners of this program are younger than I am. But so maybe in your lifetime. But it's been around for a long time, and attempts to find a better system so far haven't really succeeded. So given that, then what we should be doing is to try to develop some kind of safety net to catch people who are falling through the cracks. And that's an idea that, again, has been around for a long time, starting with things like the National Health Service in the UK and similar systems in Europe, which began after the Second World War. And those are important. Those are important ways of catching people who would otherwise be in trouble. And you're right, healthcare in the US is still a mess, despite Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, which helped and which hopefully Biden will find ways of bolstering and strengthening. But it definitely is still a mess. We're much better off with the system we have in Australia, although that's still far from perfect and needs funds to really do its job well. But I'm much happier with that than I am with the comparable systems in the US. And, you know, there are things about public housing as well, which we need to do to help people. So there are lots of things like that. But I think those are the issues where we ought to be concerned citizens, and we ought to be pushing our government to do more. And I don't think the solution is to say it's unethical to own an investment property. It's rather a matter of saying, what role does this play in providing housing for people, and can I do it well, and can I do it so it has social benefits?
Yeah, and I guess in a simplistic way, tying it into giving and generosity, again, if we go back to this idea of this spectrum thing where, you know, if we're building wealth for the absolute selfish wrong reason that I need to amass wealth as an individual, I need to be successful, I need to have more for me, it goes to intent, and that's just fraught with danger. And I feel sad for somebody who wants to just amass wealth as their own security and not give money away and not be generous. And I'm not talking about people on Struggle Street and trying to get a leg up. I'm talking about people that have good paying jobs that might be looking to invest next. I believe there's a strong argument to slow your investing down and to be a more generous person.
I think there is a strong argument to do that. And it's both an ethical argument and an argument in terms of your own satisfaction and fulfillment with life. Because I think there's lots of evidence to show that people who are just thinking about me and accumulating wealth for themselves don't end up being very satisfied. That's kind of a treadmill that you get on, and you always want more. And you're not very likely to be the richest person in the world, but until you are, you'll always be thinking, well, I'm not that well off because look at Bezos or somebody like that, they've got a lot more than I have. So that's not a race you want to get into. What you want to do is say, if I have the ability to make money, then I want to do something worthwhile with that. I want to feel that I've contributed to society and to making the world a better place. And there are lots of opportunities for doing that. I think we talked last time I was on your podcast about The Life You Can Save, an organization I founded, which provides a list of some of the most effective charities helping people in extreme poverty. And you know, that's worth going to thelifeyoucansave.org.au and seeing what's there and looking at some of those charities. I know a lot of people who find that that's added to their lives, that, you know, they have a little bit less money to spend, but they have a lot more sense of meaning and fulfillment.
Yeah. And I think one analogy that really stuck with me was, I think it was from Malcolm Gladwell's book, Outliers, and I'm kind of paraphrasing, where, you know, to get in the NBA or the NBL or elite basketball, if you're over 6 foot and a really good basketball player, an extra inch or an extra 2 inches or whatever the measurement is, it doesn't really matter because you're there. And I think with our own money and our own personal life, whatever that measurement is for you, whether it is you're comfortable with a house, you're investing for the future, and you are quote unquote there, it doesn't actually matter that much to accrue more wealth for yourself. So it's just an encouragement for everybody to maybe slow down and look at your intent with your own money once you're at that threshold of that you can provide for yourself and your own family. Cody Glenn asks, is it ethical to minimize tax purely for personal gain? And I kind of wrote a question next to this. You know, does legal always mean ethical?
Yeah, and the answer to that is clearly no. There are some things that are legal that are not ethical. I'm sure many people can think of examples of that. But, you know, one example that I think of is if you are really wealthy and you're not doing anything with your wealth to either help others or make the planet more secure, you know, reduce climate change, all of these other things that you could be doing. That's perfectly legal, but I don't think it's ethical. I think we do have a responsibility as people who are comfortably off to help others. Now, in terms of minimizing tax, I think that we should be contributing to the community. The community, the government needs revenues to do the things that we all make use of. It builds roads, it provides public transport, it provides education for our children, provides, as we were just saying, a national health service. So I think we should be willing to put in our fair share of that. We shouldn't think of the money that we pay in taxes as wasted. We should think of it as our contribution to having a community that functions well. And that's, you know, it's really important to live in a society like that, I think. We're lucky in Australia where we do live in a community that functions reasonably well.
Mm. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back right after this and Peter will answer more of your questions.
If you're after personal financial advice, don't get it from a podcast. If you would like help based on your own personal situation, head over to sortyourmoneyout.com, click get help, and we'd be happy to introduce you to one of our trusted advisors. Our panel of advisors, mortgage brokers, and accountants work with clients all over Australia so they can connect with you wherever you are. That's sortyourmoneyout.com and click get help.
Peter Matthews says, I don't know how he is with theology or praxis, but a good chunk of young people receive wages far lower than what they need. This often means having no choice but to participate in unethical things like factory farming or fast fashion. How do you balance a conscience with wage stagnation? And he's really excited to hear this as well. And he says, hi.
Hi. Do people on low wages really need to participate in factory farming? I'd question that. Yes, factory farming produces cheap animal products, but plant-based products can be very cheap too. And I don't mean the ones that you go in your supermarket and the vegan cabinets that exist now. And those manufactured products, they're not so cheap. But if you buy whole grains and pulses like lentils and beans and so on, and you cook them up the classic Indian dish dal, which is a lentil curry, is very tasty. You can make it in large quantities quite easily and freezes very well, so it's not like you have to keep cooking. And it's a very inexpensive and nutritious and balanced meal to have dal with rice. Indians have been living on that for a long time. So I don't think you do actually need to support the factory farm products. And I would say that, you know, I know people who've lived on very little and who've still managed to donate to effective charities. In fact, I had a letter or an email a while ago from someone in Brazil I've been corresponding with for a while. And he's been giving to effective charities. He recently told me that he had to move because the was living in a room, I think the building was being demolished or something, but he could pack up all his belongings in a backpack and carry his guitar in his hand. So he's clearly not a wealthy person, and yet he was still giving to effective charities.
A similar question, Olivia Grace says, I'd love to hear his thoughts on how to be an ethical consumer in our modern economy. So like the purchasing clothes, eating meat, and particularly around this, especially when the supply chains aren't super clear, what do we need to do to ensure we are making ethical choices?
Yes, it's quite complicated, as you were saying, to find out where everything comes from. As I've already said, I think it's important to avoid factory farm products because I think they are both miserable for the animals and bad for the planet. And it's better to move to a plant-based diet. And there are lots of things that you can do and lots of information online about how to do that. Now, you could say, you know, okay, but where do the lentils and rice or whatever else it is that I'm eating come from? Generally, you know, I think if they're grown here, I don't think there's a problem. And I also don't really think, despite the transport, it's bad to buy some of these things from other countries. So if you get your rice from Bangladesh, for example, it's come on a ship. It's not been flown over. So the fuel costs of ship is very low, and the impact on climate change in that way is very small. And you are contributing to the development of an industry in Bangladesh, which the country certainly needs. It's actually, you know, one of the countries that used to be very poor and is doing somewhat better now, but it is doing better because it's built up some exports. And that's true of clothing industry as well. Conditions may not be ideal, but I still think it's worth buying products that are made by people who really need that work. Those are the sorts of things to look out for. If you do have a bit of gardening or borrow some land from someone, sometimes there are community allotments, and you can grow a few veggies of your own. Well, that's both a rewarding thing to do in itself, gets you outdoors, gets a bit of physical exercise, and of course, then you know exactly where your food has come from and how it was grown. So I've done that a little bit from time to time when the circumstances were around, and I've always enjoyed it, but I've never actually managed to be self-sufficient in that way, and I don't think that's something you ought to aim at, because as I say, there are plenty of other products around that you can get.
Yeah, and I think it's important that, you know, if you do want to have intent to change your lifestyle, because me being a podcaster, I've talked to a lot of fascinating people, including you, Peter, and for me, it wasn't about overnight snap making a change. So it was like, I maybe only have, you know, I'm evil, Peter, but you know, I might only have a small piece of steak once a week. Like I had a small, you know, 125 gram piece of lean steak last night, instead of having maybe, you know, red meat four times a week. So it's more of this, I'm really cutting down and trying to be conscious, and then looking for other replacements, like maybe stir fries with chickpeas or cashew nuts. So I would like to get to the point where I'm possibly vegetarian or very, I don't know, intentional with my food. So it's not this change overnight, is it, Peter?
No, not necessarily. You're what is now called a reducitarian, or sometimes flexitarian. So, yeah, you're not purely plant-based, but you're reducing your meat consumption, and that's good for the planet, good for you, good for animals. So, yeah, I think that's a welcome movement. And you know, if more people would cut down their meat consumption and only have, you know, once or twice a week, that would be great. And as you say, the stir fries and other things can provide a good meal. I'd add tofu to the list of things that you're eating. I think, you know, a lot of people say, oh, tofu has no flavor, but, you know, there are things you do with it. You put it in the stir fry, you fry it a little bit in a bit of oil first to crispen it up. Then you put some soy, or if you like spicy food, you put some spicy, you know, chili oil or something on it. And it goes really well as part of the stir fry.
I'm kind of gritting because I didn't think we'd get to the point where we're doing the Cooking with Peter segment.
I think it's important because, you know, people want to have a diet that's interesting and enjoyable and so on. So I'm definitely not a person who just says, you know, you should just eat one thing because that's the best, you know, plan.
From a practical point of view on this, you know, reducitarian or whatever I'm becoming, like for me, the train has left the station. Amen. You know what I mean? Like there is movement at the station. But even like ordering pizzas now, I only have vegetarian pizzas because they actually, there's more flavor. I don't know. Let's just try that, everyone. Try vegetarian pizzas.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's more variety. You know, there used to just be the margarita, or there was the mushroom, or maybe there's the vegetarian, but now there are ones that have pumpkin and kale on them, or they have potatoes on them. There's a lot more around, and that's really good.
Yeah. TC asks, Is it ethical to care more about yourself and your family than others?
Well, I would say it's pretty much inevitable, unless you're a saint and you can see that halo shining brightly above your head. Then, if you have a family, and you haven't had huge rows with them all, which I hope you haven't, then it's more or less inevitable that you're going to care more about them, and you'll have some close friends that you care more about. So, you know, is it ethical? Well, I don't think there's anything really wrong with it. The question is what you do with that. And if you get to the point where all of your generosity is directed towards your family, who, you know, let's say you're Australian and you and your family are reasonably comfortably off, then I think that's getting to the point where it's infringing on ethics, because you're not leaving anything for the people who are, through no fault of their own, much worse off, and where your generosity could make a much bigger difference to their lives than it can to your own family. So, yes, care more for your family, do more for your family. I think we have to accept that that's something that we all do, that we're, if you like, we're bound to do, given the way that we've evolved, that we're only here because our parents cared for us and their parents cared for them, and so on. I think we need to accept that, but we need to put limits on it and think about the strangers that we don't see and don't know as individuals.
Do you think, some of these questions about looking after others and accruing and amassing wealth just for yourself, it speaks to this having idols in your life that can be dangerous?
Yes, if what you're thinking of is, I want to be like this person who's just made huge amounts of money from whatever it is, cryptocurrencies or something or other, and I'm jealous that I didn't get into Bitcoin, 5 years ago, that's going to burn you up. I don't think you want to be thinking that way. I think you want to be thinking about the impact that you're having on the world, and if you're going to have models to follow, then it should be the people who've been doing a lot for the world and a lot for others.
Jeremy Keane asks, I'd like to hear his opinion on the UBI, which is the Universal Basic Income, if that's a new thing for people listening, or some sort of no strings attached basic needs support.
Yes. So we were talking earlier about capitalism and about the fact that capitalism needs a safety net for the people who fall through the cracks. And a UBI is just that. It's providing people with some income so that they're going to manage to get through at a rather modest level. And in that way, it's remedying some of the deficiencies of capitalism. Now, of course, people are going to say, well, what are they going to do with it? Are they going to use it on alcohol or gambling or drugs or whatever? And then just not work, and the whole economy will collapse because people will not be productive anymore. So we that's a factual question that we need to find answers to, but there are studies and pilots that have already been run in various places, and they seem to suggest that people don't stop working just because they get a modest universal basic income. They, in fact, continue to work. Some of them actually can be more successful and can use that to lift themselves out of poverty altogether. So I think that these are things that are worth trying and worth observing where they have been tried. There are different ones going on in different countries. Some of them have gone on in affluent countries. A region of Finland tried it a while ago. But also there's an organization. In fact, one of the organizations recommended by The Life You Can Save is called Give Directly, and it does exactly what that name suggests. It goes to people in very poor rural areas of East Africa, of Kenya mainly, and it gives them, I think if I remember rightly, it's $8 a month, or maybe it's $12 a month anyway. It's something around that, and we would say, well, that's completely irrelevant. What's, getting that a month going to do? But for people whose annual income is maybe $700, an extra $8 or $12 a month does make a difference, and it gives them some kind of security. And in fact, the studies have shown that they don't waste it all on gambling or alcohol or things of that sort. That most of the people do use it, and some of them actually use it to start small businesses, to get a boost, and to work their way out of poverty.
I want to ask you a question. You made a quote, and I'm just looking on the, it's on the Think Inc. Website where you can buy the tickets. What one generation finds ridiculous, the next accepts, and the third shudders when it looks back on what the first did, okay? Do you think in this current culture of, you know, we'll call it the woke culture and people getting cancelled and all that stuff, do you think we're at a point where we're trying to preempt things? And I don't know. I just don't know if it's a fabulous quote that, you know, we look back that in the 1901, that was the norm, and then next generation, that wasn't, and then we look back and it was just all ridiculous. Do you have any comments on that quote and then just what we're seeing at the moment?
Yeah, I should say that the quote is not original to me. At least, you know, the basic idea has been around for a while. I think John Stuart Mill said something like that, the 19th century utilitarian philosopher, and others have certainly said it too. But, you know, we see it, and we've seen it in our own lifetimes. You know, certainly if you've lived as long as I've had, you've seen the idea when people who had a same-sex orientation couldn't talk about it. Basically, they were all in the closet. It was still a criminal offense to have gay sex. And we've seen, you know, that which was just the way things were, completely swung around, not only to the point where it's not criminal, but to the point where same-sex people can get married. So that's been a tremendous success, I think, in change of consciousness. And some of the issues that we've talked about, like the treatment of animals, you know, I've certainly seen when I wrote Animal Liberation, which was first published in 1975, there was quite a bit of ridicule that greeted that. I can remember being on a talk show with there was a guy called Don Lane who ran talk shows in Melbourne, and he kind of basically ridiculed it. I think he thought when I was coming on the show I was going to talk about not being cruel to our dogs and cats, and when he realized that I was actually talking about the animals that he was eating, he just, you know, couldn't really believe this and couldn't take it seriously. But of course, as you were saying, a lot of people do take it seriously now, and we haven't quite got to the level where we look back and shudder. But I do think that factory farms and the way we're treating animals right now is something that our grandchildren may well look back on and say, how could people have ever done that and thought that that was okay?
Mm. Yeah, it's just fascinating because, you know, being a podcaster, like I might make a benign joke that's acceptable today that isn't rude to anyone, that isn't, you know, racist, homophobic, any of that stuff, but I'll probably get cancelled in 20 years. Like, it's just, it's fascinating to see all this stuff unfold.
Yeah, it is interesting. And in fact, you can see it very well if you look at old movies. You know, I am some of our grandkids, I watched the movie Blazing Saddles, which I thought was one of the funniest movies ever made. But when you read it, when you watch it now, you realize, oh, this is really quite politically incorrect in some of the jokes that it makes. But look, I think we ought to you know, realize that, and we shouldn't hide these things. People have changed. In many respects, we've changed for the better in some of these things. Some of these things were offensive, tasteless, sexist, homophobic, racist. But I don't think we should not look at anything from the past. And I don't really hold with this idea of, you know, renaming buildings. So there's a great 18th century philosopher called David Hume, who I admire in many respects. But he did, it seems from correspondence, invest in a plantation that owned slaves, or supported that in the West Indies. You know, that's obviously a terrible thing to do. But so there was a Hume building in Edinburgh, because he was a Scottish philosopher, where they took his name off. I think it would be much better to say, you know, this was a great thinker of his time, but he was limited by his times in his attitude to slavery, and that's something that we regret. But we should recognize where we've come from and how we've progressed, but not judge everybody by the standards of 2021.
One final question, and I really appreciate your time today, and it might be personal and tell me to get stuffed if you like, but over your own life, like, have there been ways that you've managed and invested your own money or things that you've done just in relation to just personal finance on a personal level? Like, have you been a big investor yourself to accrue wealth, so maybe one day that you can put down the microphone and or put down the lectern and not teach? Like, what have you done in your own personal life?
Yeah, let me just say, I don't really teach at this stage because I need the money. Of course, there are good things that I can do with the money, and that helps. But I do find teaching a rewarding activity in itself. And but yes, you know, I have invested. I have investments, for example, with Australian Ethical, which is a fund that has ethical filters for the things that it invests in, and as well, it does quite well. The money grows. So I think that's a good way of investing.
Love it. Well, Peter Singer, thank you so much for your time. You can find the link to The Golden Ass in the show notes. It will be a fascinating, entertaining read for all of you. And you can see Peter live in Australia and New Zealand in August. Tickets still available. So, Peter Singer, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Glenn. It's been really good talking to you again.
We acknowledge the Darkin Young people, traditional custodians of the land on which our studio sits, and pay respect to their elders, past and present. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who may listen to our podcast.
My Millennial Money supports A21, a charity focused on abolishing slavery and human trafficking all over the world. Check out a21.org.au for more info. If you would like some other giving options, or if you're unsure about which charity you can support, head to thelifeyoucansave.org.au.
This podcast is for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general financial advice only, which does not take into account your objectives, financial situation, or needs. Because of that, you should consider if the advice is appropriate to you and your needs before acting on the information. If you do choose to buy a financial product, read the product disclosure statement and obtain appropriate financial advice tailored to your needs. Symo Interactive Proprietary Limited, the publisher of the podcast, is an authorised representative of Money Sherpa Proprietary Limited, which holds financial services license 451-289.